Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Justin Arner from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Dr. J.T. Tokish, current president of the Arthroscopy Association of North America and professor at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. Dr. Tokish was the senior author of the paper titled MRI Analysis Demonstrates Improved Reliability in Measuring Shoulder Glenoid Bone Loss Using a Two-Thirds Glenoid Height Technique Compared to the Best Fit Circle, which is in press in the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you, Dr. Tokish, for taking time out of your busy schedule, and congratulations on your presidency, and thanks for joining us.
I appreciate you having me, Justin. Thanks so much. It's a busy year and a fun year, and really grateful to Justin Makovicka, who was the lead author on this paper.
Yeah, that's awesome. I wanted to congratulate you guys on an important study, and personally doing these measurement techniques, you know, in studies and in clinical practice, I was always a little bit skeptical about where do you put the circle, and it seems like the reproducible accuracy maybe is not as great as we once thought. Tell us how you came up with this idea and how this all started.
Yeah, so, you know, figuring out and calculating bone loss is tricky. And I have a background in the military where we did a bunch of instability. So lots of experience with calculating these circles. And over time, you realize that that the circle is a little subjective. Sometimes you can make that circle a little bigger and a little smaller. And when we start talking about, you know, subcritical bone loss, for example, when we say that 13.5% seemed to be the critical number where it all fell out to, people reasonably ask, well, wait a minute, what's 0.5% got to do with this? And we're often talking about the difference between 2 and 3 millimeters, making the difference between a patient that we should put bone into and a patient that might get away with an arthroscopic Bankart. So clearly, if the margins are that thin, then I think it's critical that we have accurate measurements of these things. And I will say that we with the perfect circle, I could make the perfect circle a little bigger or a little smaller. And so I tasked the lead author on this paper, Justin Makovicka, as our fellow. And Justin really ran the ball with this. And I tasked him to say, can you go back and find out where do we get this from? Is this even true or real? And while we found it, it's one of those, you know, many things in the orthopedic literature that's kind of got this cult following or this sort of dogma producing sort of statement that we all accepted, but has never really been tested. And so that was the purpose of this study, to go see if we could test it and quantify it.
Right. I think it's a great purpose. And I remember when, as a fellow, I had the same discussions with my co-fellows about this, like, what are we really doing here? And as you mentioned before we started talking, you know, bone loss, it's such a difficult thing and pandemic almost with revision arthroscopic techniques. And you mentioned before we started about how you have to make it kind of simple and reproducible. So tell us a little bit about how you came up with this measurement technique, the percentage, how you guys came up with this. Basically, seems like a more simple and reproducible technique to measure bone loss.
Yeah, so, you know, we're blessed in that I'm in a big academic system with radiologic systems that allow constant measurement. Our radiologists, musculoskeletal trained, all one source, at least here at Mayo, but we get a lot of them in the community. And it's pretty variable out in the community sometimes about either the quality or how they are orient the scans, et cetera. And so I think there, with that variability, it's important to kind of take a look at these measures. We know that the arthroscopic Bankart remains the mainstay of treatment of shoulder instability in this country for sure. And the truth is, in spite of all the papers from the original one in 2001 with Burkhart and DeBeer, you know, demonstrating the high levels of failure with arthroscopic Bankarts and bone loss, nevertheless, the percentage of patients that do have an arthroscopic Bankart remains incredibly high, probably too high. And so if we're going to fix that, we need a couple of things. Number one, we have to recognize those patients that are at high risk. And so there's cases like methods like the instability severity score or taking other scores into account that will predict who's going to fail with an arthroscopic Bankart that are important. But in order to do that, all systems that are going to give you an idea about what's important and who you're going to have to augment, all of them require an accurate measure of bone loss on the glenoid side. And so, you know, when about 10 years ago, one of the authors on this paper is Jimmy Shahan. When he was a resident with me, he actually took on the process when we were at Tripler Army Medical Center. We had we actually had a failure rate that was higher than I was comfortable with. And so I said, we should go back and take a look at this. And so that was the paper when we published on subcritical bone loss. We let the data fall where it would, separated people into quartiles. And once it finally sort of fashioned itself out, we realized that it was far less than the 20% of so-called critical bone loss that was used. And it was a lower number than that. Now we can argue about 15, you know, the data says 13 and a half, but it's probably somewhere between that 10 and 15% of patients that are going to need to be done. The problem is that depending on where you draw that circle, a little bigger, a little smaller can take 13 and a half and turn it into 17, or can take 17 and turn it into 13 and a half. And then that's the first problem. The second problem is that many, in fact, most of the practitioners out there that are doing arthroscopic bankarts don't have access necessarily to PAX machines and accurate drawing of circles. In fact, in our city here in Phoenix, if we have our local guys do it, great. But if I get it from an outside institution, we have two big radiology places in the valley here, and one of them allows you to make a perfect circle on your PAX images, but the other one does not. And so what happens to all those people out there who don't have the ability to draw a perfect, quote unquote, perfect circle, even if it is accurate? They don't have access to that radiology films. And we thought, okay, is there a simpler way that we can do this? And is two-thirds even accurate?
Yeah, that's great, great advice and great point. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I recommend the listeners look into basically that 67.8%, the glenoid height, and basically, it's just a more reliable technique to measure to the base of the coracoid. And like you said, I've had the same issues. So, you know, you mentioned a little bit about the imaging, and I see you use three Tesla MRIs. Can you just talk to us about a little bit about CT versus MRI and 3D CT and just your thoughts and gestalt? You know, certainly you're an expert on this field and the best techniques that way.
Yeah, I remember, many years ago, we had our musculoskeletal radiologist at Tripler, where we sort of defined a lot of this work. We were getting CTs and MRIs on everybody, and he used to come back. His name was Ken Lindell. He's a phenomenal musculoskeletal radiologist. And he came back and I said, Ken, is there a difference between the MRI and the CT? And he said, no, the MRI is equally equivalent. And then, of course, we had a series of studies that came out that showed that CT scan is, quote unquote, the gold standard because of bone. And that's fine. Certainly all of us would agree you can see the bony contours of a CT scan a little bit better than you can see on the MRI. That's true. I think Ken was right, too, though, in that the way he did his MRIs and the way he set up the protocols for the MRIs, they were so consistent and so good that we had a very, very high inter-observer reliability. But that's not the case in the real world, right? Not everybody's out there is a Ken Lindell, and not everybody out there controls their entire healthcare system where every radiology tech is trained the same way, et cetera. So we have to account for that variability. What we found was that if you really do have a very standardized way to go about this, that the MRI is as accurate. But the CT scan, true too, also remember, they have to orient it along a certain plane. And there have been several studies now, one by us, one by others. Matt Preventure published on this as well, that if they go back and reformat the CT and they're off in terms of where they, not necessarily off, but if they just format it in such a way that's not truly perpendicular to the face of the glenoid, it can really overcall and undercall bone loss. And so what we want is the MRI is nice because it's a little bit more standardized in terms of how the formatting gets done post study. And so if you've got that MRI, it's a pretty reliable way to be able to say, yep, we can get this, we can get it every time. We believe the MRI is the better measure for this, not because it's necessarily more accurate, but because it's as accurate and doesn't have the radiation potential of the CT scan.
Yeah, that's for sure. I did a posterior instability project with Dr. Bradley and Dr. Prentcher, found the same thing. You know, if you reorient the image, you get a total different reading. And, you know, getting the 3D models are nice, but sometimes in our system, it's difficult to measure, like you mentioned on the 3D model. So it's a good point. The other thing I saw you mentioned in your paper, which is pretty interesting, you know, if you have a substantial amount of bone loss inferiorly, it's really hard to even know where to put that circle in, which I think is interesting. So tell us a little bit of how you evaluate bone loss. I mean, you're the guru of this. Do you use this two-thirds technique clinically, or has it changed your practice?
actually do every time. I calculate bone loss in every single patient that comes through it. We did a paper which validated the on-track, off-track method. I got interested when DiGiacomo and Bradley and Eji Itoi, three of my heroes, sat down and said, hey, what we realize that bone loss is bipolar. They wrote that up, as you know, back in 2014, I think. And that changed the world in helping us understand it's not just the glenoid side, but we have to be able to calculate a track. So then we were in the midst of all this bone loss stuff and thought, gosh, does this matter? Does the track matter? Or is this a cool radiologic measurement? So we went back and looked at our patients at Tripler with three of us that were pretty busy sports surgeons doing lots and lots of these Bankarts. And we found that the glenoid track actually was a very good predictor. I think what we found was that if we were on track, that we had about an 8% failure rate. And if we were off track, it was, you know, five times higher than that, four times higher than that. So from that standpoint, we said, and gosh, this is very important to be able to calculate that. In addition to that, if you were off track, you had a really high chance of having a poor outcome, even if you didn't redislocate. So it was even more important than just figuring out recurrence was to figure out, you know, whether these patients did well. So when you ask a soldier who was out there, and we'd say, hey, have you redislocated after this? And they'd say, no, I'm okay. Then we'd say, well, let's take a look at how you're doing. And we'd measure their WOSI, and they were doing terrible, almost as bad as somebody who had recurrent instability. And so we realized a couple of things then. Number one, you can't use recurrence as your sole measure of outcome after shoulder instability surgery, because they just never got to this position, into the abducted external rotated position. So that was number one. And then number two, we found that the glenoid track actually is a very good predictor of who was going to do well and who was not going to do well in that population. And of course, therefore, you have to have accurate measurements of these things. So, you know, we went ahead and said, okay, I tasked Justin and a couple of our other folks, Jimmy Shea's on this paper too, because he became our fellow, but they went out and took a look at a whole bunch of our own ones now here at Mayo, and said, first of all, number one, is there a flexion point at the base of that coracoid? In other words, is there that posterior superior glenoid tubercle? So we made sure we blinded everybody to that. Some of the people that do these studies, they take a snapshot of the ideal shot and they put it in a PowerPoint. It's a little bit of a cheat code, to be honest. We did not. We had them kind of have to go through and look at these themselves so that we couldn't cheat and pick the one image that everybody say, oh, okay, that's good. Because that's part of the deal, right? Is can you go through the image and are we all talking about the same flexion point and image? And so they were very, very close in terms of their reads. The inter-reserve reliability was very, very good in terms of that, even better than the two-thirds circle method. And so now for me, when we come through, bone loss is one measurement. It's not the only measurement, but it is the hammer, right? So if you've got a bone loss that's above a certain amount, you're not getting an arthroscopic Bankart from me. It's just not happening. And because we know the failure rates are 30, 40%, people say, well, that's not my failure rate. And I'd say, have you followed your patients 2 years? Have you followed your patients 4 years? Because I used to say the same thing. And I've learned this the hard way over the years. And these patients are just getting shuttled from one surgeon to the next sometime. And so I would tell you that if you have significant bone loss, forget about any of the rest of it. That's enough to tilt you over to do something else. Now, whether that something else is a rib massage, or that something else is a glenoid bone graft, or it's a Lattiger, I think that remains to be seen and remains to be determined. But and we can get into that discussion if you wish. But I think for now, just an arthroscopic Bankart, we've got to know better and we've got to do better than that.
Yeah, you're right. Like you said before, is making this easy for all of us to measure and evaluate is important in busy clinical practice. You know, talking about the humeral sided bone loss, tell us how you measure this. Are you doing the on-off track? And it seems like the more we learn, the more we realize that it's probably more complicated, you know, how wide, how deep, how long. Tell us kind of your gestalt of what you're looking for when you see these humeral-sided bone loss, and what do you do about it?
Yeah, the problem with the Hill-Sachs lesion is it's not, it doesn't read the book, right? So glenoid bone loss is usually fairly standard. It's fairly parallel to the long axis of the glenoid. So you don't get it in different shapes and sizes per se very much. It's usually right along that long axis. The humerus is an entirely different thing. It depends on what position the arm was in at the time of that initial dislocation. So DiGiacomo and Maddie published this too, where they looked at the difference between what they called an abducted Hill-Sachs lesion and an adducted Hill-Sachs lesion. And actually what they found was the adducted lesion was probably a little bit more common. So that's the linebacker who's not up in the outstretched up position, but he's down in it with his arms at his side and then, you know, has an arm tackle and that guy rips it out and he gets forced external rotation. That one's tough because the Hill-Sachs lesion is still there. It can still be engaging, but it's not amenable to that standard remplissage that we all do. So not all Hill-Sachs lesions are amenable to those. Okay, so when you've got the big Hill-Sachs lesion, what we would say is we rely on track, off track for this a lot. And there's a couple of really good papers out there, one by Peter Millett that I would call everybody's attention to, and that is this. Peter, when he was doing Laterges, did a really elegant study of looking back and finding out when he did his Laterges, did he take them from off track to on track, right? That's our goal. And so when you add that bone to the front of the glenoid, you extend the arc, you make the bike tire bigger, if you will, and then hopefully the pothole doesn't fall into the pothole. But in Peter's cases, there were many of his cases where he did not. He left them. Even though he did a very beautiful Laterges, he still left them. They still were corrected and they were still off track. And guess what? What he found was no patient in his series had a good or excellent result if they remained off track after surgery. Now, our European colleagues are so aggressive with the Laterges that they do it with no bone loss. And in their case, they almost never have an off-track lesion when they're doing it, or often don't have an off-track lesion. But the caution I would have for folks is if you're doing this in Laterges in the setting of bone loss, usually in that 20 to 25, 30% range, if you don't correct that to the on-track method, that guy's going to still engage and you still have a problem with outcomes. So how do we approach it? Well, the remplissage has changed a lot. I will be honest. When it first came out, I thought the remplissage was going to be a flash in the pan. Here's why. It's simple, like it's slick, right? And you can bill for it. And so when you've got those three things in the hands of us as orthopedic surgeons, Katie, bar the door. We're going to adopt that thing and run it up the flagpole. We're going to tell everybody how great it is. And it's awesome because I can do it. And as you know, we do these in very fast time, very efficient. And now I've got a bill for it. Let's go. And that's a problem, I thought. But in truth, the data has come out and they're, you know, 2015, I think Boileau published the first large scale series of this and it was very good. But then Neurosat comes out with a paper, shows one third of patients still have posterior shoulder pain. And then John Kelly, God bless the right Reverend John Kelly, he's as big a proponent of the remplissage as there is anywhere and actually did a number of the critical studies to bring this up. He with Grant Garcia. And what they found was return to sport was a little sketchy, 68%, I think, in basketball, football. So it was that two-thirds to 70% of patients that did not return to sport after that. So what about direct head-to-head studies with that versus the Laterges? And I think our best data, at least right now, comes out of Bob Arciero's group, and Yang is the lead author on that. And they did a series comparing Laterges to remplissage, and they found that equivalent results, and there's lots of studies out there showing equivalent results, except for contact athletes, where 30% of the remplissages fail, or revision surgery, where they and others have showed really high failures in revision, not revision remplissage, revision surgery. So be careful. If you've got a contact athlete, somebody who's got a revision, or somebody that's got bigger bone loss, the remplissage does not perform as well as does the Laterges or the bone blocks. So how do we employ it now? Well, the data is getting pretty clear. There, you ask, well, which patients would you do a remplissage in? I'd say, well, any patient that I'm doing a Bankart in. You might even say patients, people tease me about this because I've made a couple comments in this regard. Well, what about a patient who doesn't have a Hill-Sachs lesion? And I say, well, I make one. And I sort of say that tongue in cheek, but the truth is, yeah, it's not a bad idea to go up and just roughen it up next to that area, because the truth is that the data is really clear in almost every study that's been done across the board. You're playing for a tie. You're hoping to get as good a result with a Bankart as you get with a remplissage. So who would I not do it in? I wouldn't do it in a throwing athlete. I think that's a tricky one. So that patient can't have it. Now, if you got a throwing athlete with a big Hill-Sachs lesion, good luck, buddy. That's a big problem. But so a throwing athlete, I don't do it in. I don't trust it in a revision case, and I don't trust it in a major contact athlete person there. In those patients, I think you have two choices. For me, I actually do a bone graft on the glenoid side, and I tell them I make the dance floor so big that they can't dance off of it. So that's a distal tibia or an iliac crest or whichever your graft de jure is to choose. I don't use our distal clavicle graft for those big ones because it's not a big enough graft. So for small subcritical bone loss, I'll use distal clavicle. For bigger ones, I think Matt's graft with the distal tibia is an excellent choice. And I think even Frozen's, as Ivan Wong has shown us, is a pretty good choice too.
That's a great synopsis. You know, banking off your discussion about graft size, you know, certainly with your experience, it's interesting for me to know you hear all these stories about resorption and screws and buttons. Have you seen resorption in Laterge, DTA? Does it matter the size? Tell us kind of your thoughts about resorption of the grafts.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's a hot area right now. So for young surgeons that are out there that are looking to kind of start doing some studying and looking at a topic that is unsettled, look into this topic. The truth is, I've seen every graft resorb. All of us have. You know, the classic study was by DiGiacomo, where he took a look at the Laterge afterwards, and he found, I think it was 57%. Don't quote me on that number exactly, but 57-ish% of the superior half of that graft went away, and that's concerning because what's left there is a bare screw, right? And so, and I would say that some of my distal clavicle grafts, we've done a number of those, we'll see a little bit of milder resorption. I see less of it as a percentage, but it's usually a smaller graft. I've seen distal tibias that melt away. So with all due respect to some of the studies that are out there, anybody that's done a bunch of distal tibias, we haven't figured that out yet either. Many of those get away and go away. I've also seen distal tibias that don't move a lick. I mean, I've probably got 15 or 20, I CT all of them, and I've got 15 or 20 of them that it looks as good as the day it was born in there. Now, how to fix them? I think we must move away from screws and put in buttons or some sort of equivalent with that. And the reason that I say that is not because it's superior yet, but because nobody's going to adopt the screws. So what happens is people come out and they go, I don't want a Laterge. Why not? Well, because there's a not insignificant risk of injury and the case is hard. So most people are not comfortable with doing those, and therefore they don't do them. They go back and they do another arthroscopic Bankart, which then, of course, unfortunately fails. So we have to either teach more Laterges, which is what our European colleagues tell us to do, and that's one way to do it. Alternatively, however, we should maybe make this procedure simpler. So we and others have developed different techniques about how do we make that bone block work and how can we do it. The problem is, from the front, you can't put screws in a bone block unless you go all the way to the medial port, you know, the Halifax portal, if you will, with Ivan Wong's technique. It's doable, but you're making a big hole in the pec. Doesn't seem to be a problem. So I think Ivan's a genius, and I think his technique is excellent. I don't think it's ideal yet. It's not optimal. And the reason is that it's dependent on the graft guide that you use. And that guide can't put the bone in on FOSS. It has to put it in like it puts it in, which burrows a pretty good sized hole in the soft tissues on the way in. So ideally, we'd like to change that. So the technique we've described and a few others are doing is we can put it through the interval. So a couple of the key procedures here. Number one, the graft should be able to be done arthroscopic because most of our surgeons are not going to convert to open surgery. That's just the truth of it. So we have to make it easy enough where the arthroscopic surgeon who's not comfortable open will do this arthroscopically. Perfect. Number two, we have to be able to introduce the graft through the interval because splitting the subscap always puts the nerve at risk and it's hard. So even after 80 arthroscopic Laterges, you still run the risk that nerve is right there. And so if you're a wizard, great, do it. And you can get that thing and set it apart. And it's beautiful. The problem is that the vast majority of these are not going to be done by you know, Pascal Boileau, Laurent Lafosse, or some of the people in our country that are doing them. The vast majority are going to be done by people who say, I'm not even going there. Okay. So it has to go through the interval. We have to get secure fixation. Can't do that from the front with screws. So they have to be either drilled from the back or we've got to change the technology. I think with the emergence of some of the suture buttons and cables and a couple of the things that are just on the horizon, we'll have that problem solved. Now, the challenge is Ivan Wong has done a study, a comparative study, where he's looked at his comparing buttons versus screws. And what he found was that the buttons had a pretty high failure rate. And then people have argued, well, you don't use fresh distal tibia, you use this frozen stuff. But he was pretty good in that study. I think anybody that hasn't read it should go back and read it. Ivan did a really nice job of removing variables. And that's the best data in the literature. So we should be nervous about that a little bit. The other thing Ivan says, which I think is really smart, is that I tell you that I've got these great CT scans at 3 months and 6 months, but he's got his now, some of them are out at 5 years. And the remodeling process continues to take effect there. And so who knows? I will say this, all of them remodel. And so if you've got, well, I think one of the reasons the Latter J still works is you still got a screw there. But it's also the reason that we have to go back so often and remove screw hardware for painful issues after Latter J.
And certainly that's not benign. Going back into that scarred mess to remove a screw is not fun, not fun for anyone. So you alluded to this. Tell us a little bit about how you're approaching it. And these critical bone loss, you know, 15%, are you using your elegant distal clavicle graft, more revisions DTA? I know I've seen some great talks from you, especially at this ANA annual meeting, and how you use the basically suture anchors as buttons. Tell us a little bit about just your typical thought process with these different cases.
Yeah, so I would say that with all those principles in mind, having to do it arthroscopically, having to do it through the interval and not through a split through the subscap, having a big enough graft to correct the bone loss, and then making a simple and safe and reproducible method. The first time I think Pascal Boileau deserves a lot of credit because he's the first one to say, you know what, I'm going to use a suture button. I did suture anchors when we originally described the distal clavicle. I put two suture anchors and used a double pulley technique to slam it down. And the truth is, it works. There's another study out of China in 2000, I think it was 2017 maybe, that showed that too. They did it and it worked. And so I thought, okay, that's reasonable. Just suture anchors and then you could put two holes and double pulley it and slam it down. The problem is, when I was really being honest, I could still wiggle that graft a little bit and I didn't love it. I mean, it works and it's good, but I thought, gosh, these patients are, I want something better. So when Pascal came out with his button, I thought that was a pretty good idea. Well, we were very comfortable with ACL tightrope fixation and with syndesmosis screw fixation now with these adjustable buttons. And so I went to one of the companies and said, hey, I want to see if I can use your syndesmosis fixation, which has buttons on it for me to do this with bone loss. So we went to the lab and originally they were too short. And so we had to figure out how to lengthen it sort of by hand. And so we did, we made that work. So my first probably 5 or 6 cases was me using that. We watched them very closely. We're very careful about how we did that. We did CT scans at 3 months and then MRIs, not much. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. Wouldn't it be nice if we could remove the buttons altogether? So there are an emerging group of companies that will create all soft tissue buttons. Wouldn't it be nice, ideally, if we have no metal in the shoulder and we can still do these things? So now there's soft button constructs out there. And so we started doing soft button constructs with that. And that was actually even better. There's a cerclage technique out that I've also used. That one is good. I worry a little bit about it eroding the bone in between. So I believe that we should be doing longitudinal compression only and not across the bone compression. But it can work very well, especially if you leave the cortical edge of a bone on there. And then I want small holes. So these can be done because they're not 4.5 or 4.0 screws. We can use, you know, 2.75 suture buttons, et cetera. You can actually do these through a 1 millimeter or a 2 millimeter drill hole, retrograde load them so the button can't come back through, but the rest of the suture material can come through. So imagine now we've got a drill that goes through the glenoid that's no bigger than, you know, 2 millimeters to 3 millimeters compared to having to do a 4.75 or something like that. I think we preserve that glenoid bone across there. And now that's what we've done. We probably got, I don't know, close to 50 now with these various differences, and I'm still evolving in how we do this. And I would say I've had one failure. Actually, I've had two failures that I know of. One was college wrestler, so that's on me. And ended up wanting to go to MMA. So we fixed him. He failed on that one. He's tougher than me. And then the second one was a hockey player that was a really interesting story. He failed 2 arthroscopic bank cards. I did an arthroscopic DTA on him. He came back after playing 50 game or 40 games. And then he was hit again and redislocated. I thought, oh my God, here we go. So we went and found him. We re-scanned him. His glenoid bone loss was gone. He had remodeled his graft, a big graft. into his shoulder, and he had a perfectly circular glenoid. So now I got a problem. I'm like, well, he doesn't have glenoid bone loss. It's gone because we grafted it, but he's recurrently unstable. And so then there was this argument, should you try to do another arthroscopic bank card? And I said, no way, we're doing a ladder shake and remplissage and throw the book at him. So certainly have had a few failures, but I'll tell you with this one, I've had some incredible results. Some seizure patients, for example, and this is one that I really like this application for. If you get a seizure patient, they say, the neurologists always tell us, oh, their seizures are controlled, don't worry about it. And then they're going to have a seizure right after you do that operation, right? It's like the Murphy's Law. So with seizures, imagine now you've got those screws in and now they've broken those screws or bent those screws. We've all seen those cases. Those are disasters. They're hard. You got to go in and bear out those things, and it's a rough day. So now the buttons happen. And let's say you have an all suture button that you go in and you treat somebody with that. Let's say they do have a seizure, and let's say they break that stuff down. You're dealing with broken stitches. That's a fairly easy thing to go in back in and fix without all the destructive nature of that. So eventually, I think we get to all soft tissue buttons. I think they have to be shown biomechanically equivalent and clinically equivalent. But if we can do that and make this thing easy, then I think that surgeon who's comfortable with the arthroscopic bank card, it's not that big a jump to move from that to an arthroscopic bone graft.
Yeah, it's an elegant technique. And like I mentioned, there's some good recordings from the ANA meeting that you're showing your technique and some nice arthroscopic techniques, ATEC techniques about it. So appreciate it. Awesome discussion. I know you have a lot on your plate today, so I don't want to take up any more of your time, but really appreciate your explanations and sharing your results and pushing the envelope. We certainly owe a lot of gratitude to you to make this difficult situation better. So thanks for your time.
Well, I'm honored. And Justin, what you guys are doing with the podcast and you in particular is really taking us to a new level, man. So as Anna's, I guess, current president and the guy that they've given the keys to the car with, I just want to thank you personally for the work that you and what Matt has done on this. I think getting the ability to have conversations like this and to be able to bring in this interactive nature between surgeons, I think is really helpful for all of us, especially for the young folks. So we're in your debt, my friend, and look forward to many more to follow.
Thank you, Dr. Tokish. Appreciate those kind words. Dr. Tokish's article titled MRI Analysis Demonstrates Improved Reliability in Measuring Shoulder Glenoid Bone Loss Using a Two-Thirds Glenoid Height Technique Compared to the Best Fit Circle is in press in the Arthroscopy Journal and is available online at arthroscopyjournal.org. Thanks so much for joining us. This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.